Do not talk at meals. Do not talk in the transport. Do not talk travelling. Do not talk in the billet. Do not talk by your own fireside. Be careful, even in your hut. That was Bletchley, and we were expected to exercise the same discretion.
A remarkable section of the book, Anne. First of all, let's explain your background. What did you do? You didn't actually work at Bletchley, did you?
No, I didn't. We were on the what are called the Y stations, which were the listening stations. They were all over the world, and all three services were operating them, and some civilians were operating them as well. We didn't know about Bletchley Park. All our messages went away, usually taken by dispatch riders. We had no idea where they were riding to, and you jolly well didn't ask. But they had to do the decoding. We didn't know what it was we were taking down. And it was 30 years before I first heard the word Bletchley Park. Up until then, the place that was looking after all this stuff was called Station X. We actually were not all that interested in the decoding. We were never going to know whether they could undo our messages or not. But we had another job we were being trained to do at the same time, and that was to recognise whether a message was coming from a ship, in particular, of course, a U-boat. We thought that was where our principal usefulness lay. I'm not sure now that that was true, but it was what we thought at the time. So if we recognised a signal as coming from a U-boat, we had to work very, very fast indeed, because any ship at sea made a very, very brief signal. They tried to maintain radio silence, but the U-boats did have to report back to their headquarters, and we had to recognise that it was a U-boat that was transmitting, shout out the frequency that we were on, and that would go to the direction-finding stations all over the United Kingdom, who would immediately have to switch to the frequency and take a bearing. And this, we understood, went to the Admiralty, didn't know quite where else, but we understood that it went to Admiral Sir Max Haughton, who was in Liverpool, commanding Western Approaches, which had the responsibility for fighting the U-boat war in the North Atlantic. And this information was all plotted on great charts up the wall, tended by Wrens on ladders, who were having to go up to the ceiling to put the position of all these ships. And this supposedly led Sir Max Haughton to say that either Wrens must be issued with bell-bottom trousers or all future convoys must be routed south.
What a remarkable tale. Individually, did you know what was going on? Collectively, you were all working together and for the good and for the common cause. But individually, did you actually understand what the information was actually leading to?
No, not honestly, not until we read the intelligence surveys after the war. And it was 1981 before the main British official book, Wartime Intelligence, Hinsley's book, that came out about the naval aspect of the use of British intelligence. And it was only then that we got a picture of what had been going on. I particularly remember March of 1943, when the U-boat war was at its height. I remember it because my father's birthday crops up in March, and it was on his birthday that I was on duty. And we had a most terrible hard work, nothing to what the poor sailors at sea were having to endure, I admit, but we hadn't time to drink any tea. There were so many ships signalling, so much activity going on. And it was the biggest U-boat battle of the war that was fought in that March of 43. And it was when Admiral Dönitz made his, again, quoting British intelligence from the book that was published in 1981, we knew none of this at the time. We knew things were pretty tough because we'd got this tremendous amount of work going on. British intelligence says that the sea battles that were fought between about September and May, or December and May, I think it is, of 1942 to 43 were among the greatest sea battles there've ever been.
You say rather easily that you were taking down the information. I'm assuming the signals that you were listening to were either in German or Japanese.
No, code.
In code?
Oh, they're all in code.
So that makes it even worse. I mean, yeah, how? Absolutely. How did you take it down? How did you learn this?
You're taking it down in Morse anyway.
Right.
If you had been a German sailor or a Japanese sailor, you would have had no more idea. Come to that, a British sailor would not have had any idea what the message he was transmitting said. Code was used all the time. So everything went from the telegraphists, who were actually involved in the communication through the air waves, and the decoders. The messages would all go on to decoders. Low-grade messages before the war, the coder was also the signaller, I understand. I don't know. But one of the things about the war was that jobs were broken down into smaller and smaller components so that you could train people more quickly, get more of them onto the job, more and more people, but smaller and smaller job. So we were entirely concerned with receiving, and because, of course, we were only listening, eavesdroppers, we did not even learn to transmit. And this was one of the first things in our training that we couldn't understand, because we kept on and on trying to get our speeds up and never being invited to transmit, never being shown how to transmit, and we couldn't understand it. We weren't going to be any use as telegraphists unless we could transmit Morse, but we were never shown how to. And then they let us into this terrible secret. They made us sign the Official Secrets Act. And then they said, well, now you're going to be told, you're going to be intercept telegraphists, and you're going to be listening to the German Navy. And you've got to get identify these ships so that we can sink them. And I was shattered. I had no idea that's what I was going to be asked to do, and I didn't want to do it. I was a bit Victorian, I suppose, really, but to me, women were the nurturers, not the destroyers. It was the men who were there to do the destroying. We were there to pick up the pieces. I thought when I asked to be a telegraphist that I was going to be a kind of 999 telephone operator sending ships to the rescue, and then I got told that I was going to be part of the destroy mechanism and felt as if I'd been appointed a member of an execution squad. I was so unhappy that I went to our chief Wren instructor and said, could I be transferred to the other branch? I couldn't do this job. And she said, don't know what's come over you. It's an absolutely marvellous job. And no, there's no prospect. You know, now you know about it and you know what you're going to be doing. That's it. That's your job, this war. And of course, my friends said, do you think everybody else can do all the dirty work and you can't, you know, knuckle down to it? But I'd lost my zeal until an extraordinary thing happened. And it was on the 25th of June, 1942. And the Daily Telegraph printed a long article about what was happening to the Jews in Poland. There were accounts of Jewish men and boys being sent out with spades to dig graves, stand in front of them and get shot. There were accounts of women and orphans being massacred. There were even, this was the very, very first hint of this, there were even vans having poison gas exhausts put in and killing people by gas. This was, and we knew, of course, we'd known since before the war that the Jews were being discriminated against. And of course, when I read that, I knew that I'd got to do the job.
Anne Glyn Jones is with me, I'm very glad to say. Morse Code Wrens of Station X. A marvellous book, and a book that's been written with a great deal of humour. I'm assuming, Anne, you couldn't have survived without that sense of humour.
I think it would have been difficult. You certainly needed it. We had some considerable difficulties to deal with, like cockroaches all over the floor. And as we were having to... this is on the ship going out, RMS Orion. And as we had to share mattresses on the floor because there wasn't enough bunk space, cockroaches were rather a menace. So that was one of the things that it was a good idea to have a good bit of a laugh about, especially as my best friend in the Wrens very nearly went back on the whole overseas idea because of creepy crawlies. Creepy crawlies are bound to be awful.
Just tell me of roses, cap badges, and officers that really should know better.
I rather think you're thinking of the night that we were in Algiers. We'd gone ashore and had found a tolerably respectable bar and had been given, while we were there, there were 12 of us, and we'd all been given a bunch of roses. So when it was time to go back to the ship, which we did when the petty officer who was in command of us told us to go back, because we were very good little wrens, we headed straight back to the ship, went up the gangplank and found the duty officer very angry, and he said, you're all adrift. We said, we're not adrift. We've stayed with the petty officer and we've done exactly what we were told. And he said, these wrens are all defaulters, he said to the duty petty officer, fall them in. duty officer said, "Get fell in." So we got fell in, and the duty petty officer said, "Wrens shun." So we shunned, came to attention. Anyway, our feet did, but of course our hands couldn't because we were all holding bunches of roses. And he said, "You can't hang on to them roses. Put them down." And we said, "Well, no, we can't do that because we're all very attached to our own particular roses and we don't want them all muddled up on the deck." So we were still arguing about this when the duty officer came back and he said, "Are those wrens ready yet?" And the petty officer said, "I can't make them put their roses down, sir." And he said, "Oh, never mind, I'll talk to them as they are." I think he was slightly regretting this whole episode. Anyway, the duty petty officer turned back to us and said, "Wren platoon, off, caps!" Well, we'd never had an order like that. Wrens don't suddenly take their hats off. Seamen do, but wrens do not. But we thought, well, this is a good idea, really, because we all know our own hats. We'll put our own roses in our own hats. So we broke ranks without any further commands, lined the hats all up at the bulkhead, put our own roses in our own hats, and then got filled back in again. And the duty officer then informed us that we were supposed to come back half an hour before the petty officer and not wait until the petty officer came back. And we said we were very, very sorry. We hadn't known that. The petty officer spoke up for us too. She said she hadn't known that either. And we were, of course, reprimanded and told not to do it again. And when this was all over, the duty petty officer said, "On, caps!" So we broke ranks again and fetched our caps from the bulkhead and put them all back on again. But it took ages because we hadn't got any hand mirrors to look in. Hats are difficult to put on. There's curls to be arranged. And also we'd all got hats with HMS on the front. We had to make sure that the M was in the middle of the front. It took a very long time to get the whole thing sorted out. I just slightly doubt if that young duty officer ever defaulted a bunch of wrens again. We were finally told that we could go to our cabins, and we did.
Second World War put on hold just for a moment or two there. Had to be.
I guess so.
What rank were you in the Navy?
Well, in the end, I was a petty officer, but it took a lot of fighting for. We took our leading rate exams before we were ever sent abroad, which I was sent abroad in summer 43 I was sent abroad, and we'd done our leading rate exams. We were quite confident that when we reached our destination, wherever it was going to be, which we didn't know, wherever we reached that destination, we were sure we'd get our leading rate when we got there, but it wasn't there. And to cut a long story short, we didn't get it for, I think it was very nearly the end of the war before we got it, because quite obviously all our papers had got lost. That's what had happened. We all got crosser and crosser and more chocker. And the Admiral, I must say, it says well for the Navy hierarchy that it reached the Admiral's ears in Gibraltar, where we finally ended up, that he'd got a bunch of very angry wrens sitting on top of the rock. He sent for us and said, "Why were we so upset?" And we said, "Because we'd done our leading rate exam." And he sent a signal. We were rated up by return of post, but it didn't stick, because when we were then sent back again to England, which was a pretty exciting thing because they sent us back on an aircraft carrier, regarding the life at sea as being sufficiently safe by then that they could risk letting wrens travel as transit passengers on the naval vessels, I came back on an aircraft carrier called HMS Ravager, which was ordered into action in the Bay of Biscay, which was all quite exciting, although I've got to admit that I never heard anything happen. We were sent to the sick bay to nurse the wounded. The OMO only started giving us first aid lectures after the action station bells had gone. A bit late, but yes. Anyway, we did our best. So let me see. Now, where was I? Oh, coming back as a leading wren who hadn't got it. And that went on, and we progressed from being chocker to being what the Navy calls stroppy. We became very uncooperative and very difficult, and my book has a picture of us on parade demonstrating that we're stroppy. We've all got faces like thunderclouds.
For those that don't have Jack speak, you better explain chocker.
Oh, chocker, I believe, comes from the old chocker block, but it means you're absolutely fed up. There isn't room for anything more.
If I can ask you just to read the epilogue, because the final words I find rather sad, because you do point towards not only a great change in your life, but in technology and you hint that, of course, this will never happen again.
Well, the book is concerned to quite a large extent with what was involved with our training, a tremendous lot of technical radio, technical wireless and Morse and everything. And you have to bear that in mind as you read the closing page of my book, which says, "Radio technology was to change swiftly and radically after World War II. In 1947 came the invention of the transistor, and much of what we had studied so diligently in our technical wireless classes became obsolete. Ahead lay the chip, the microchip, the computer, satellites, the NASA space program with all the radical technological spin-offs that were to transform communications. By 1987, automated global satellite technology was replacing wireless telegraphy, and in the summer of 1997, half a century after our demobilisation, the Royal Navy ended all training in wireless telegraphy, though Morse itself continued to have relevance for visual signalling. Before the millennium ended on February 1st, 1999, Morse code had been officially superseded as a method of formal communication at sea. Shortly before this, in 1993, the WRNS itself ceased to exist as a distinct entity, being incorporated into the Royal Navy, with Wrens serving alongside sailors on equal terms, bar, at the time, some restrictions applying to submarine service and the Royal Marine Commandos. The calling to which we had dedicated ourselves and the service within which that calling had been pursued were no more. We had passed into history."
You consider yourself an historical piece?
Yes, I do, in more ways than one.
And thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.